Welcome to the Chrisman Commentary Daily Mortgage News Podcast. I'm your host, Robbie Chrisman. Topics on today's episode include an update from UWM, an excerpt of an interview with Bank of Oklahoma's Chris Maloney from last week's Mortgage Matters show on all things capital markets, from supply and prepayment speeds to the evolution of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet over time, and the latest inflation reading. Thanks to this week's podcast sponsor, PHH Mortgage. From subservicing to correspondent lending, MSR/co-issue transactions, portfolio retention, reverse mortgages, and commercial servicing, PHH has solutions for the entire mortgage lifecycle. In a message to mortgage brokers, United Wholesale Mortgage defended itself from the Hunter Brook Media's report last week, titled "The Lie That Helped Make UWM America's Largest Mortgage Lender," a report that claims UWM steered loans. The wholesale lender said it's offering legal support to partners in case they are sued, and once again accused Rocket Mortgage of being behind the report, which Rocket apparently has denied. Hunter Brook Media reported that over 8,600 loan officers at independent brokerages were little more than retail outlets for United Wholesale, and sent UWM more than 99% of their mortgages in 2023. More than doubled the number of partners sending 99% of their loans to the lender in 2020. Hunter Brook also claims that borrowers paid a total of $229 million more in closing costs with UWM loans over the past 4 years than the average price loan. A lawsuit filed by borrowers soon after the Hunter Brook report states that UWM created a corrupt scheme with loyal brokers to send loans its way, applying excess fees and costs. UWM CEO Matt Ishbia responded with, quote, "If any of our partners get roped into their frivolous lawsuit, UWM will cover your attorney fees in connection with these fraudulent claims. We've seen ambulance-chasing attorneys try to scare consumers and brokers," end quote. UWM's social media post noted that it's not uncommon nor illegal for a broker to send most or all their business to a specific lender. It's not unique to UWM brokers, nor this industry. "We are 100% confident nothing needs to change or will change because of Hunter Brook's disinformation. The only way they win is if UWM or brokers change behavior." For today's interview, I wanted to play for you an excerpt from last week's Mortgage Matters show presented by Lenders One, in which my dad and I interviewed Bank of Oklahoma's Chris Maloney on all things capital markets, from supply and prepayment speeds to the evolution of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet over time. Today's Lenders One show at 2 p.m. Eastern features Kathy Kraninger, former director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau from 2018 to 2021, now CEO of the Florida Bankers Association.
These different companies are originating loans, whether it's retail, wholesale, direct-to-consumer, correspondent, whoever, and they go into pools and they are sold into the capital markets, into the secondary markets. From a secondary marketing perspective, do investors look at the products or look at the loans with an eye on the company that originated that loan and have interest in pools that have certain loans that are originated by certain lenders, or shy away from certain pools that have loans from certain lenders?
Well, yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, every servicer out there, every issuer out there is like a human being. Everyone is unique in their own way. Some issuers are very, very aggressive in terms of wringing prepayments out of their mortgage pools. Some are not. So that's certainly something we look at. And you will either get a pay up or a penalty, depending on who issued that loan or really who's servicing it. Because especially if you look at the non-bank servicers, some of them tend to be very, very aggressive. They're very good at squeezing refinancings, even out of loans which are deeply out of the money. So absolutely, servicers and issuers matter.
And so you see that price difference. You might, like a pool of servicing that might be sold that is originated by ABC, you may have an investor of servicing that may not even bid on that pool based on the aggressive refinancing practices that that lender has.
Well, yeah, like for example, there are certain, like Quicken, of course, is right up there. They're very, very well known for being highly aggressive and they're incredibly good at it. I mean, whether you're in the money or deeply out of the money, they tend to exhibit higher than average speed. So any investor will look at that before they bid on a pool. They want to see who issued it and especially who was servicing it, without a doubt. I wouldn't consider it so much as they penalize you. It really depends on whether or not the borrower, the pool is trading either at a premium or a discount.
Chris, I believe that agency prepayments are released after tomorrow's close and into the evening. What are you expecting from that? What are we seeing recently in terms of performance?
Well, really, right now, in aggregate, speeds are really at turnover speeds. Both Fannie Mae and Ginny Mae, for example, 30 years, you look at them, they're trending near the lowest speeds we've seen in decades. And the reason for that is obvious. QE4 came and really turned the apple cart over when it comes to mortgages. You have an immense percentage of the outstanding universe right now sitting on mortgages, which are far, far below the current lending rate. If you look at conventionals, and Ginny Mae looks the same way, about 70% of all people wrapped up into 30-year conventional loans are paying 4% or less. They're about 300 basis points out of the money. So when are those people ever going to refinance? So your aggregate prepayment speeds are falling into the three Ds, you know, death, default, divorce. That's the only way you're getting turnover right now. And, you know, there are certain geographic regions which pay faster than others, but even that's been flipped on its head. You know, New York State is always slow for the reasons that when you either refinance or you buy or sell a home here, the taxes are onerous. So that, of course, shifts the elbow of where you're going to refinance. But California, for example, which used to be a very fast state, because of what's happened with so many homeowners sitting on such historically low mortgage rates, is actually very slow right now. And that brings into mind, how big is the average loan within that geographic footprint? California home prices, because they just refuse to build any single family homes out there, single family home prices out there are very, very high. And it hurts much more to refinance a high balance mortgage when it's out of the money and you go into a higher mortgage rate than it does to refinance a low low balance mortgage loan when you go into a higher mortgage rate. So it's really, I have never seen in my 30 years of doing this where essentially up to about 2 or 3 months ago, and right now in aggregate about 3% of the 30-year universe in both conventionals and Ginny Mae has refinance incentive, meaning 50 basis points or more. For about the past 2 years, that's essentially been 0%. I've never seen that before in my career, and I doubt I'll ever see it again. At least I hope not.
Why is this so important? Why should originators care about this? And Dad, I'd like you to hop on after Chris answers.
Well, with an originator, you know, refinancing is really your bread and butter. That's your low-hanging fruit, so to speak. You know, a refinance loan is much easier, cheaper, and faster to pull off than, say, a purchase loan. And traditionally speaking, maybe 70%, 60, 70% of all mortgages generated come from refinancings. Now that's completely dried up. I believe purchase loans make up, I'm speaking off the cuff, 85 to 90% of all mortgages which are being created right now. And that's really shown in your gross issuance numbers and how many mortgages and what the unpaid balance of them coming into the market is. You know, right now, last year we saw just shy of $1 trillion in gross issuance in agency mortgages. That's the lowest we've seen since 2014. The reason for that is the collapse in refinancings and what that has led to in our industry. You've seen mortgage employment collapse about 33% since its recent high, which I believe was in the summer of 2021. We are back in terms of aggregate employment in the mortgage industry to where we were back in 2014. So you've seen a lot of layoffs. The good news is I think the worst of it is behind us because they've really right-sized the industry. But it's going to be at least a year or two before we see the ability of American homeowners who have refinancing incentive to come back to its normal percentage of the universe of about 20%. So we're not out of the woods yet, but I think we've been through the worst of it.
Obviously, I'm not going to disagree with anything Chris had to say. From an originator's perspective, he's right. If I'm a loan officer or a broker and I'm doing my book of business, oftentimes the conversation will be, hey, look, you want to get this house. This house is in that school district that you love. You know, you've got two school age kids, you want to move there. Forget about rate for now. At some point when rates go down, we can refinance you. Let's just get you in that house at, 8% or 7.5% or whatever it is. And then I'll watch rates for you and we'll stay in touch. And, there's a certain amount of handholding that goes on with an originator and a client. When that kind of goes away, when, to Chris's point, we have millions of borrowers out there with rates in the twos and threes, fours, whatever, that are so much lower than now, then yeah, Chris, the three D's, death, divorce, and default. I think when you look at the MBA's stats of the applications coming in, I think the percentage of refis is actually a little bit higher. And what I'm hearing is because so many people have 25 or 30% credit card debt, that even though refinancing that debt isn't tax deductible, still paying 7 or 7.5% is better than 25 or 30%. And if you have a lot of credit card debt and a lot of equity, maybe do a HELOC or maybe refinance, whatever it is. So there is some of that going on, in terms of just natural refinancing that's going on. And at some point, yeah, people will catch up. But I think that what we saw in 2020, 2021 was cramming, 4 or 5, maybe even 6 years of volume and profits into those 2 years. And you had a situation where these companies, the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, were there as outlets for this product, and the servicing, the correspondent buyers, the AmeriHomes, the PennyMacs, at that point, Wells Fargo, whoever, they weren't paying much for servicing. So companies held on to their servicing. In the last year or two, those companies have needed that servicing, that they like the cash flow, but they have this asset, which for many independent mortgage banks is their only asset. And so they've been selling the servicing. And when you're an IMB and you've sold your servicing and you're still barely breaking even or maybe losing, it'll be another tough year, I think, for companies who have sold their servicing, don't have that servicing income, and they aren't making a lot of money, and the volume isn't there, and we're heading into this purchase season where typically you start to see a few more for sale signs on the block. Inventory is still relatively low. Chris, to your point, if I've got a 3% loan, you have that lock-in effect where I'm locked in, and maybe we don't need the 4-bedroom, 3-bath ranch style house because my kids have moved out. But dang, if I'm paying $1,600 a month, and if I decide to move somewhere else, I'm going to be paying $3,200 a month. I'll stick with my $1,600 a month.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right in what you said. The fact that what happened in 2020, 2021 jammed about 6 years or so of production into those 2 years. And that's the complaint I've always had about easy monetary policy from a central bank. All it does is cheapen money and pull demand forward. And you eat tomorrow today, and it leaves tomorrow flattened. And that's where we are right now. But, you know, you never want to go all zero hedge on everyone and say everything's falling apart. It's not. You know, bottom line, it's important to keep things in long-term perspective, even though right now, if you look at existing home sale inventory, it's running at about 1 million units. That's half the average run rate we have seen since this millennium on average, because of so many people, as Mr. Christman said, sitting in their houses and not moving. But both as a market participant and as an investor, you have to keep the long-term perspective in mind. All we're going through right now is the end result of another bout of easy money released by the central bank. We've been through this numerous times before. Look, our nation's first financial panic happened back in 1819. We've had plenty of credit booms and busts since then. We're going to have another after the one we're getting out of right now. We've seen this before, and this too shall pass. In another year or two, hopefully we'll be out of this.
Regardless of the administration, the business cycles are alive and well. They are what they are, right? So,
Chris, but before I get you too lathered up about the Fed, and I do have a couple questions about the Fed, I want you to explain one other thing, and that's the U.S. MBS excess return, which has been an excess return as of late. You write a daily economic commentary. It's personally my favorite in the industry. And there's several topics you opine on. This is one of them. Kind of just like I asked you to put into layman's terms for sales staffs, why prepayments matter, performance matters. You write a lot about the U.S. MBS index delivering as of late excess returns. What does that mean, and how do investors respond to this to, I guess, bring things back into equilibrium?
Well, the U.S. MBS, mortgages are an incredibly unique beast, which is why I fell in love with them years ago when I was a portfolio manager. Now, you look at excess return, it is really just the performance of an asset class taken into consideration the risk-free rate of return, in this case, treasuries, but you segment it everything into duration buckets because you try to compare apples to apples. For example, the U.S. MBS index duration, which is a measurement of how sensitive your investments are to changes in interest rates, is different from the duration of, say, the U.S. Treasury index. So in order to compare apples to apples for excess return, you segment the components of your index into what they call duration buckets. For each all your components, you try to ascertain how sensitive they are to changes in interest rates. Mortgages, we use something called key rate durations. I'm not going to go into it mathematically, but that's what basically excess return is, our return compared to what's expected looking at the riskless rate of return. Now, of course, treasuries have risk, just not credit risk. You'll always get your funds returned to you on a nominal, if not a real basis. Now, the same does hold true for agency MBS, because both conventional and Ginnie, as conventionals are now wards of the U.S. government, they're also backed by the taxpayer. But mortgages hold additional risk. And really, it's you have duration drift because you don't know when you're getting your money back from mortgages, because mortgages are continuously callable at all times. This is what makes them so interesting, but that also makes them hard to compare to other asset classes, which is why you use excess return, which takes into account all the duration risk embedded in mortgages. So an investor in mortgage-backed securities, you need to get compensated for the extra risk of not knowing what your future cash flows will be. We'll try to model them, but again, it's guesswork. It's an educated guesswork. And excess return, to my mind, is the best indicator showing you as an investor, were you compensated for that risk or not? Now, last month we were. We had 34 basis points in excess return compared to treasuries. That was the first positive month of excess return this year. And right now, April and May tend to be pretty friendly months, seasonally speaking, for mortgage performance as well.
Why? And how does that come back into balance?
Well, most of your issuance for mortgages tends to come about towards the end of the year, because there's a seasonality to home sales, and home sales feed supply into our market. Most home sales take place really like from April through September. Once the kids go to school, people aren't looking to move anymore. Takes on average 45 days to wrap up those mortgages, securitize them, and sell them off. So most of your issuance on average tends to come in the fourth quarter. If markets are efficient, where's trading come from? Now, you look at the way markets work. It's like a trade in baseball. Everybody's opinion about the same thing is different. We all look at the same data sets for the most part, but everything we do in markets, you're trying to forecast what's coming down the pike, and everybody has a different opinion about that. That's where trading comes from. We might look at the same exact bond under the same exact circumstances, and you have a difference of opinion on what the net present value of what you believe is going to happen in the future is going to be compared to what I believe the future is going to be. You know, when we buy and sell something, say we buy and sell a bond at $15, that doesn't mean we believe the bond is worth $15. I'm selling it to you because I think it's worth less than $15. You're buying it from me because you think it's worth more than $15. So over time, and with enough people doing it, are markets efficient in the long run? Usually. Are markets efficient in the short run? No. In the short run, markets are driven by greed and fear and emotion. But that's what sparks trading.
We had some bank failures, right? And oh my gosh, the sky is falling. Silicon Valley Bank, senior, whoever, they're having to they're being forced to sell mortgage-backed securities. The spread between treasuries and mortgage-backed securities really widened out, you know, to say, let's say 3%, whereas normally it's 1.5%, whatever the spreads are. But oh my gosh, will it ever come back? A, have you seen it come back? And B, where do you think it'll go from here? Because I tell people, even though treasury rates might be the same, if the spread narrows, mortgage rates may actually improve relative to treasuries, because treasuries aren't moving much, but mortgages, the demand is still there. So what's going on that side of things?
Well, in terms of mortgage spreads, you know, I tend to follow the current coupon spreads in both conventional and Ginnie compared to the 5-10 Treasury blend. It's just a traditional way to look at it. And even I look at option adjusted spreads as well, and mortgages look fairly priced right now compared to where I believe they should be. Now, are they going to widen out going forward? And again, this is foreseeing the future. This is my opinion. I believe no. And this is compared to treasuries. Right now with treasuries, and people are finally, the first time in my 30 years doing this, waking up to the fact that there's been no adult supervision over DC in decades. The budget deficit is absolutely out of control. If you look at what the CBO estimates are for deficit spending, up until, I think it's 2035, they're looking at $2 trillion. And this is looking through sunny, rosy spectacles. They're looking at $2 trillion per year going forward in additional deficit spending. Mortgages right now on a supply-demand basis look much, much better than treasuries. Of course, you always have overseas demand for treasuries, et cetera. But you have a Federal Reserve right now, which is also talking about cutting rates into an environment where I think, in my opinion, very arguably, there is still a ton of liquidity sloshing around the system. You look at the Chicago Fed National Index of Economic Financial Conditions, it's deeply into easy territory right now. And that latest SEP where the Fed said, we think inflation's actually going to tick up this year, and we're going to do 3 cuts this year. That right there does not bode well for treasuries whatsoever. So I think mortgage spreads, compared to treasuries could tighten as we go through the year. And this is even as interest rates go up.
There isn't much to report from yesterday, as market participants were waiting it out for today's release of the March Consumer Price Index, and for good reason. But first, the main economic release yesterday was the NFIB Small Business Optimism Index, which fell for a third consecutive month in March, dropping to its lowest level since December 2012. Firms reported sharply lower sales expectations from the previous month, and price pressures in finding quality labor were the primary issues facing small businesses in March. It's not a major economic release, so it doesn't move rates, but is still a measure worth noting. Today's CPI report will shape markets' thinking about inflation trends and the likely path for rates. Lower rates would certainly be welcome, especially considering that bond yields hit a 2024 high earlier this week. Headline CPI rose 0.4%, as expected, on a month-over-month basis, flat from February, though it was up 3.5% year-over-year, an increase from 3.2% in February. Core CPI came in slightly higher than expected month over month, but slightly less than expected year over year. Later today brings remarks from several Fed speakers, wholesale inventories and sales in February, a couple Treasury auctions headlined by $39 billion of reopened 10-year notes, the March budget deficit, and the minutes from the March 19th and 20th FOMC meeting. The minutes will likely include a clearer signal about the timing and pace of rate cuts this year, and may also lay out the criteria for when the Fed will begin to slow the runoff of its holdings of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. After the inflation data, agency MBS prices are worth a quarter to three-eighths from Tuesday, and the 10-year is yielding 4.45 after closing yesterday at 4.37%. The 2-year is up to 4.84%. Let's wrap up with a joke and some housekeeping. An accountant and a lawyer were lying on a beach in Hawaii sipping Mai Tais. The lawyer started telling the accountant how he came to be there. "I had this downtown property in Memphis that caught fire, and after the insurance paid off, I came here." The accountant replied, "I had a downtown property too, in Miami. It got flooded, so here I am with the insurance proceeds." The lawyer took another sip of his Mai Tai, then asked in a puzzled voice, "How do you start a flood?" Thanks again to this week's podcast sponsor, PHH Mortgage. From subservicing to correspondent lending, MSR/co-issue transactions, portfolio retention, reverse mortgages, and commercial servicing, PHH has a solution for the entire mortgage lifecycle. If you have any questions about the podcast or sponsoring opportunities, send me an email at robbie@robchrisman.com. Visit robchrisman.com for more information on our industry partners, access to archived commentaries, and how to subscribe to the daily mortgage news and commentary. To listen to or download past episodes of this podcast, search Mortgage News on any platform you get your podcast from.